Picture the scene. May 17, 1943. A Boeing B-17 Flying Fortress, olive drab and neutral gray, battle-worn and patched in a dozen places, crosses the English Channel one more time. 10 men inside. The pilot is 23 years old. They've been to Bremen. They've been to St. Nazaire. They've been to Lorient and half a dozen other places that made grown men lie awake, staring at the ceiling the night before. And today, today they are coming home for the last time. That airplane is the Memphis Belle. And the story of what she carried, what she survived, and where she ended up is what we're talking about today on The Hangar. I'm Tail Dreger, and this is Radio Hangar. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now, to understand the Memphis Belle, you have to understand what the 8th Air Force was facing in 1942 and into 43. The American Daylight Precision Bombing Campaign over occupied Europe was, to put it diplomatically, a brutal equation. The theory was sound enough. You fly in daylight, you can see your targets, you hit the factories, the rail yards, the submarine pens, you cripple the machine that feeds the German war effort. The B-17 Flying Fortress was designed for exactly this. Four Wright R-1820 Cyclone radial engines, a wingspan of 103 feet, a service ceiling pushing 35,000 feet, 1350 caliber machine guns on a fully armed ship, the Norden bombsight supposedly capable of dropping a bomb in a pickle barrel from 20,000 feet. The reality was a different picture entirely. German anti-aircraft batteries that put up flak so thick you felt like you were flying through a solid wall of black smoke, Luftwaffe interceptors hitting the formations in coordinated waves, and the cold, at altitude. The temperature inside an unpressurized B-17 could drop to 40 or 50 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. Men frostbit their fingers handling their guns. Oxygen masks iced over, the heating suits when they worked, were prone to short-circuiting, and you were in that airplane for 6, 8, 10 hours at a stretch. The 91st Bomb Group, based at Royal Air Force Basingbourne in Cambridgeshire, England, was one of the first American heavy bomb groups to fly combat over Europe. They called themselves the Ragged Irregulars. Their losses in those early months were the kind of numbers that don't make it into the propaganda newsreels, whole crews gone in an afternoon. Aircraft that took off in the morning and never came back. The assigned tour of duty for 8th Air Force heavy bomber crews was 25 missions. Finished 25 and you went home. It sounds almost reasonable until you run the math. In the summer of 1943, the statistical odds of surviving a full 25 mission tour hovered somewhere between very poor and nearly impossible, depending on whose numbers you trusted. Some crews didn't survive their first 5 missions. The math was something the crews understood without ever talking about it directly. You went anyway. That was the job. The Memphis Belle was assigned to the 91st Bomb Group, 324th Bomb Squadron. Her pilot was Captain Robert K. Morgan, a young man from Asheville, North Carolina, who had learned to fly before the war and found himself at the controls of a 4-engine heavy bomber over some of the most defended airspace in the world. He named the airplane after his girl back home, Margaret Polk of Memphis, Tennessee. He had the nose art painted on, a reclining pin-up figure and the name in script, and then he carried that name through everything the Luftwaffe and the German anti-aircraft batteries could throw at them. The crew of the Memphis Belle was what you would call a cross-section of America. Co-pilot James Varinas from Connecticut, navigator Charles Layton from Vermont, bombardier Vincent Evans from Arkansas, radio operator Robert Hansen from Michigan, top turret gunner and flight engineer Harold Locke from Wisconsin, ball turret gunner Casimir Nastel from Pennsylvania, waist gunner Clarence Winchell from Oregon, waist gunner John Quinlan from Massachusetts, tail gunner Cecil Scott from Michigan, 10 men from 10 different places, packed into a 104-foot aluminum fuselage, flying through some of the most dangerous skies in the history of warfare. They flew their first mission in November of 1942. They flew through the winter and into the spring. Each mission was a new calculation. Every man who walked out to that airplane understood that not everyone who walked out always came back. The Belle took damage. She came back on 2 engines once. She came back with holes in her skin that the ground crews patched before dawn so she'd be ready for the next mission. The crew chief, the ground crew, the mechanics at Basingbourne, they were part of this too. They kept her flying. Now here's where it gets interesting. The Memphis Belle was not, strictly speaking, the first 8th Air Force crew to complete 25 missions. The crew of the Hells Angels, flying with the 333rd Bomb Group out of Molesworth, appears to have reached that milestone a few days earlier by some accounts. But the Army Air Force's publicity machine was looking for a story. They needed something they could show the American public, something that said we are winning, something that would put faces and names to what was happening over there. The Memphis Belle, with her romantic name and her photogenic crew and that nose art that would look good on a newspaper front page, was the story they chose to tell. William Wyler, the Hollywood director, was a major in the Army Air Forces at the time. He would later make Ben-Hur and dozens of other films, but in 1943 he was over England with a camera and a flight suit. He flew actual combat missions to get his footage, breathing through an oxygen mask at altitude, handheld cameras freezing up in the cold. What he came back with eventually became a documentary called The Memphis Belle, a story of a flying fortress, released in 1944. Americans lined up to see it, because these were real men flying real airplanes into real danger, and the film made that undeniable. You watched it and you understood something that no press release could communicate. After the 25th mission on May 17, 1943, the crew was brought back to the United States. They went on a war bond tour. 30 cities across the country. Crowds everywhere they landed, ticker tape in some places, handshakes and speeches and photographs. Robert Morgan and his crew represented every bomber crew still flying over Europe, every family back home waiting for a letter that wasn't a telegram. They did their job on the road the same way they'd done it at altitude, over occupied territory. They showed up and they did what was asked. But here's the thing about the airplane herself. The Memphis Belle was eventually handed over to the city of Memphis, Tennessee, and for years, for decades, she sat outdoors, Tennessee summers, Tennessee winters. Rain and sun and humidity and bird nests building up in the turrets. Paint peeling back to bare aluminum. She was moved around to different display spots around the city over the years, some of them decent, some of them not. By the time anyone with real resources and real authority started paying attention, she was in rough shape. Not a wreck exactly, but weathered, tired. In the kind of condition that tells you the decades of outdoor exposure had cost her something real. She was a landmark in name. People in Memphis knew the Memphis Belle, but she was slowly becoming a lawn ornament when she deserved to be a memorial. In 2005, the aircraft was transferred to the National Museum of the United States Air Force at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, and the museum set about doing what had needed to be done for a long time. The restoration of the Memphis Belle took more than a decade. The teams who worked on her were not just mechanics. They were historians with wrenches. Every decision was a question. What stays original? What has to be replaced for structural integrity? What can be saved and what has to be replicated? The fabric control surfaces, the plexiglass in the turrets and nose, the electrical wiring that had baked and cracked through 40-plus years of outdoor display. All of it had to be evaluated and addressed one piece at a time. They stripped her back and found the history underneath. The original paint scheme came through in places. The olive drab and neutral gray exactly as it had been applied at the factory and touched up at Bassingbourne. The mission markings on the nose, 25 small yellow bomb symbols, each one representing a mission flown and a crew that came home. They documented everything before touching anything. They photographed every rivet and every patch, and they found the battle damage, evidence of repairs made during the war, at the forward base, by crew chiefs and mechanics working nights, to have her ready for the next operation. There were patches over holes that had been there since 1943, history preserved in the metal itself. The restoration was completed in time for the 75th anniversary of the Memphis Belle's final combat mission, May of 2018. The aircraft was unveiled and placed in the World War II gallery at the Air Force Museum in Dayton, where she now stands among other survivors of that era. The B-29 boxcar is nearby, the Waco CG-4A glider, aircraft that each carried something enormous through the worst years of the 20th century. Robert Morgan had passed away in 2004, a year before the transfer to Dayton. He didn't live to see the restoration completed, but in interviews he gave over the years, he was clear about what the airplane meant to him. It wasn't the fame, it wasn't the bond tour, it wasn't the documentary, it was the 10 men who flew her. The crew chief who kept her engines running, the guys who loaded the bombs and fueled her up in the dark before a mission. The Belle was the vessel, the people were the story. Pull up a chair and think about what it means to stand under that wing in Dayton. That airplane flew 25 missions when 25 missions seemed almost impossible to survive. She was shot up and patched up and loaded with bombs and pointed at targets that mattered to the outcome of the war. 10 men trusted her to bring them home, and she did. Every time, and then she sat in a Memphis park for 40 years while the weather slowly worked on her. The restoration at Dayton got it right. She is inside now, out of the rain, properly supported, properly lit, under a climate-controlled roof. You can walk the full length of her. You can see the nose art and the mission symbols and the patches over the battle damage. you can look up at the top turret position and think about what it meant to ride in that spot at 25,000 feet over Germany. If you have never been to the National Museum of the United States Air Force in Dayton, it is free to get in, and it is one of the greatest aviation museums anywhere on Earth. The Memphis Belle is reason enough to make the drive on her own. My main sources today include the National Museum of the United States Air Force Restoration Documentation, the historical records of the 91st Bomb Group, and the Memphis Belle Memorial Association. You can find more at radiohangar.com. I'm Tail Dragger, safe flying.